last week's State of the State address, California Governor Jerry Brown laid out what's being hailed as an ambitious energy plan. He said the state must act boldly to combat catastrophic changes to the climate system. The plan has three main goals. Half of the state's electricity would come from renewables. It would reduce petroleum use in cars and trucks by up to 50% and double the efficiency of existing buildings and make heating fuels cleaner. Governor Brown set new benchmarks but offered few specifics. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about how these goals could be achieved and how they could reshape the state's energy landscape. Today, we are joined by Dan Kamen, professor of energy at UC Berkeley, where he holds appointments in the Energy and Resources Group, the Goldman School of Public Policy, and the Department of Nuclear Engineering. And Dan joins us from his office in Berkeley. Hi, Dan. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Peter Miller is Senior Scientist in the Energy and Transportation Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council. He has over 25 years of experience in energy and climate policy. And Peter joins me here in studio. Hi, Peter. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So, Peter, I'll start off with you. The energy policy that Governor Brown announced last week is getting national attention, and it's being hailed by a number of environmental groups. What are your thoughts on it?
We're really pleased to hear Governor Brown's leadership on this critical environmental issue. California's been a leader, and Governor Brown's inaugural speech, historic fourth inaugural speech, really reaffirmed that leadership and showed the way forward.
And what was your reaction when you heard about the plan, Dan?
Well, I was very pleased to see it. I think it's nice to see the different elements. The 50% clean energy target is really continuing the current state evolution. And the plan to clean our vehicles is critical. And then the plan to make buildings an even bigger part of the clean energy agenda. What it speaks to me, is what California's been doing now for over a decade, which is really integrating in all of the pieces of our fossil, our energy use, both in our power plants and in our vehicles. So it's a really good step along a pathway for which we're all aiming to a 2050 target, which is dramatically reduced, not 50% down, but really 80% down in all fossil fuels. And this is a key step along that path.
So taking a step back and looking at where we currently are, Governor Brown and many other environmentalists often say that California has the most far-reaching environmental laws of any state. Is that true? And what laws, Peter, would you say currently make the most difference?
Well, by far and away, California's climate change law, AB 32, sets the stage for climate leadership, not just in the country, but across the world. California has set the target for reducing our greenhouse gas emissions economy-wide. And that's a tremendous step, and it really helps to integrate, as Dan said, all the sectors of the economy in a way that helps to build the economy and help our environment.
And what would you add to that, Dan?
Well, I think so California has got a set of things, and we've been a leader on many of them for decades. Energy efficiency goes back to the early 70s, building efficiency about the same time, vehicle standards also then. But ever since the mid-2000s, when California passed its climate law, the California Global Warming Solutions Act, Assembly Bill 32, or the Pavley-Nunez Bill, depending which of the terms used for it. That's been the framework, and that says that we're going to get back to where we were in 1990 by 2020. So that's kind of getting, sort of correcting the last couple of years of growth in emissions, and we're on pace to get there. And then all of the other pieces, there are clean energy standards, which we call renewable portfolio standards. There's standards around our vehicle fuels, low-carbon fuel standards, something my lab helped develop. And then there's standards for how much emissions are associated with land use change and planning, and it's Senate Bill 375. There are many others, but all of these fit together in a really important network. And so what California has is what I would consider kind of a dense, self-supporting network. And so we have, for example, a target to have a great deal of solar rooftops, a million solar rooftops by 2020. We also have a plan for a million electric vehicles on the road by then. Both standards may actually get increased in the coming years. And they work together. Not every home is going to have solar roof and electric vehicle, but we have mandates in each area. and there's agencies that work on them, but these things are all tied together. And so California really has this organic, evolving plan where all these pieces are right now working together. There's lots of challenges and lots of problems with different issues. We have a cap and trade market that's got some challenges, but this is a evolving system working towards that. First, that 2020 plan, then the 2030 plan the governor announced, and then the 2050 plan.
As it stands, we don't have many specifics from the governor directly. And according to reports, in order to implement these new policies, the legislature either has to pass laws or Governor Brown could sign an executive order. How do you think this will happen, Peter? How will this play out?
Well, that's a really good question. We started back around 2002 by passing a renewable portfolio standard that said the state had to get up to 20% of its electricity from renewable energy sources. We revised that to move it up in time and to accelerate the and to increase the target, so that currently California has a law on the books that says we have to get a third of our electricity from clean renewable sources by 2020. We're well on track to meet that goal. We're going to get there. Governor Brown has set a new signpost out to 2030 that we're going to get half of our electricity from renewable energy resources. And I think the question now becomes for the legislature and for the state agencies and for stakeholders, what's the best way to ensure that we get there? And I think there'll be a lot of discussion about whether new legislation is needed or whether an executive order is the right way to go.
And then what does the dialogue look like between groups like yours and the legislature? How will you make your voice heard and members of environmental groups? How can citizens make their voices heard on this?
Well, I think it's critical that all stakeholders and your average citizen make their voice heard. We get a lot of support across the state for clean, renewable energy across the political spectrum. It increases our energy security. It helps build our economy. California's got some of the best renewable energy resources in the country. And we should take advantage of that to grow our economy and to provide stable sources of power to power our society.
Dan, do you think that this will come through laws or maybe an executive order? How do you think it should be carried out?
Well, those are two different points. I mean, I think we ultimately want and will get a law, but you know, politics plays out in fits and starts and might come with an executive order first. I tend to think what we will have is the process that we're on right now. That is, there are disagreements across different groups in the state, both political and technical and economic, around which mixture is the best path. But there really isn't a disagreement that, just what Peter said, California can get there, and I think you know, are very diverse groups, from industry groups to academic groups, think tanks, environmental justice groups looking out for the rights of lower-income Californians, are all essentially agreed that the path will happen. There's lots of churning in the details, and the fact that we are, as Peter said, on or even a little bit ahead of schedule for 2020, this one-third of electricity from renewables, made the 2050 target something that we had many hearings about, and some groups proposed 45%, others proposed 55%. There was a whole range. My personal favorite number was 51%, just to take us over the halfway point. And that's the path we're on. When we do our analysis, and I run one of the big models of not just California's energy system, but also across Western states, we see a whole range of paths. Ones that are really solar dominated, those that are very wind based, that have lots of geothermal. There are arguments in some camps for more controversial sources, hydro, nuclear, and things. But those solar and wind ones and lots of efficiency are generally everyone's kind of most people's sweet spot. And we see that as technically feasible, economically may actually benefit the state in terms of jobs and power costs. And so it's really an argument around what are the political steps you need to keep this ball moving along. And so I wouldn't be surprised if we had an executive order, but that we followed up with legislation to build and extend and expand upon this AB 32 law.
That is Dan Kamen, professor of energy at UC Berkeley. We're also joined by Peter Miller, senior scientist at the National Resources Defense Council. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about California Governor Jerry Brown's green energy plan that he laid out at the State of the State last week. Again, it has three main goals, and we'll go into detail on these three. Half of the state's electricity would come from renewables, up from a third today. Reduce petroleum in cars and trucks by up to 50%. Double the efficiency of existing buildings and make heating fuels cleaner. Now, all of this is supposed to happen in the next 15 years, which means we will see the effects of this. We might see less carbon emissions, more electric cars. So what questions do you have about this plan? How do you think this should be carried out? If you work in the environmental sector, what are your thoughts on this? If you work in the green tech sector, a lot of green tech companies have been talking about this, especially wind and solar companies. We'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What does this mean for the future of California? And then the LA Times editorial pointed out that you've got to have other states also jump in on this, because it's great that California is doing this, but what does it mean for the rest of the country? You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Peter, what are your thoughts on that? I thought that was a really great editorial in the LA Times. They said, yes, let's celebrate this. But when you look at what we're actually facing, this massive, well, the climate change is just a crisis right now. And if other states don't jump in and implement similar policies, what will it mean for the big picture, really?
Right. And it's critical that we do get support and participation and active policies from other states, not just other states, but other countries around the world.
Right.
And fortunately, we're seeing a lot more action. The U.S. just signed an agreement with China. That's really promising. We're working closely with other states, not just on climate, but specifically on renewable energy. California's dominates the Western electricity grid. But there's opportunities across the West for increased renewables, and states like Washington, Oregon, Nevada, Arizona are all looking at renewable energy as a great source of local jobs and electricity.
And Dan, President Obama just signed an executive order, a new methane rule. It will regulate the amount of methane that oil and gas producers are allowed to vent from their wells, pipelines, and other equipment. I'm reading from Mother Jones right now. According to the White House, the rules will slash methane emissions 40% to 45% by 2025. So what are your thoughts on that LA Times editorial that it's great that California is doing this, but we need the federal government to stand up and other states?
Well, I mean, it's essentially we need everyone to stand up. The climate story is one that California plays a hugely important role in, not only because it's a big economy. California is about 2% of the world's emissions. And so that's not trivial, because if you can manage 2% well, then you can manage 6 and 8 and 10 and 20 and 50% well, so you can kind of build up. So greening our economy, doing it reliably so our power is reliable, affordable, is critical. And having others partner with us. So right now we have a carbon market, and our trading partner sort of bizarrely is Quebec, but California is allowing carbon trading with other subnational units, one in Brazil, one in Mexico, and there's discussion about expanding that. So there's a lot of exchange. I think everyone who works on energy and climate in California, whether in universities, think tanks, government offices, gets a constant stream of visitors from countries and states overseas that are looking to do the same. And so what the LA Times pointed out is exactly right. I like to say that California is doing it right internally, but critically needs a foreign policy. And it's things like the agreement with China that President Obama signed, but also Mexico is looking to build a carbon market, largely because they see economic opportunities to trade with us. There's wonderful wind and solar in northern Mexico, and they could sell it here as low-cost green power. So there's a lot of features of the story. But I think that the piece of it that you began with the beginning is really critical, and that is this is not just about electricity, not just about vehicles. It's also about buildings and how we manage them more smartly. And ultimately, we're going to be thinking about managing the carbon embedded in things we buy. Goods and services, when we open a bottle of water, there's carbon embedded in that, not physically, but in terms of the life cycle to get it here. And California is an absolute leader in figuring out all of these pieces. So when you look at the vehicle one, that 15 years is kind of interesting because that's roughly the turnover time for our whole fleet. That's just looking at the average of when vehicles get used and turn over and when they come in and out of the system. And so you're basically talking about during that time, we want to transform the system. And right now, California is on a plan right now to have about a 17th of all of its vehicles electric by 2020. And pretty clearly, those standards are going to have to go up. And so these pieces all work together. You get more solar rooftops. You have more power to charge up your electric vehicles. You get more solar buses or fuel cell buses. These are all pieces that work together. Many of those technologies we buy from overseas. Some of them we make here. We buy them from Asia. We buy them from Europe. And that's another way in which this clean energy economy ties in the different countries that work together on this, countries and states like ours.
That's Dan Kamen, professor of energy at UC Berkeley. Peter Miller is senior scientist with the National Resources Defense Council. Today we are talking about Governor Jerry Brown's energy plan that was laid out at the State of the State last week. And we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about it? What comments do you have? What do you think of these new energy goals? And what does this mean for the future of the state? There's a lot of other aspects to talk about. For California, the drought is a huge one. And actually, let's go to a caller who has a question about that. Let's hear from Isabel in Berkeley. Hi, Isabel. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. And thank you very much for your guest's very articulate report on this new bill. My question is this. What, if any, is the drought, how, if at all, is the drought going to affect these goals, especially if we're actually looking at a significant climate change in California towards more dry weather?
Well, that's a great question. And just to give an update, NBC is reporting that 100% of California remains in drought after only light to moderate rain fell in parts of the state during early January. And then Bloomberg is reporting that the drought outlook is going to be extended through April. A friend was just in Tahoe over the weekend and said he was shocked because there's no snow. It's most of it's man-made. So how does the drought factor into this, Peter?
Well, the drought is an indication of the kinds of problems we're going to see increasingly frequently as climate change progresses. So it's a real, first and foremost, an indication of the urgency with which we have to address this problem. Second, we have a pretty extensive hydropower system in this state that relies on snowpack, rainfall to fill the dams, and provide a low-cost, flexible source of power. So the less rain that falls, the harder it is to ensure that we've got electricity to power our economy. So it increases the challenge. But overall, I think these goals are achievable, and we have to find ways to ensure that we can build that clean energy economy and continue to provide reliable electricity services under a variety of different climatic conditions.
And Dan, what are your thoughts? How will the drought affect these plans?
Well, it's really central to them. I mean, in fact, part of the story is that we're interested in reducing carbon emissions, but we also need to conserve other resources, land, water, et cetera. And so when we think about California and the whole snowpack issue, which is a great way we store water and then also energy up in the mountains, when the snow gets reduced or when the timing changes so that we don't get snow but we get more extreme storms in the spring or fall, that changes what our system can do. And so one of the things that the state agencies that I work with ask me to do with my modeling team is to envision a world in 2050 where we have 50% less energy coming from hydropower than today. And that's a huge change in the system. One of the interesting features about renewables is that when you run a coal or a gas or a nuclear-fired power plant, you need water for cooling. And so there is a water demand, and the water demand goes up in the hot times in the summer, right when there's stresses on the water system. So it figures indirectly. The early large-scale solar systems that we installed in the desert needed water for cooling. But as one of the responses to that, the systems that are being installed now actually use air cooling. And so one of the interesting sort of co-evolving stories is large amounts of solar, be it big fields in the desert or be it rooftop systems, are a way to actually reduce the water intensity of our energy system. And all of the modeling groups, the state agencies, the people building prototype systems, commercial systems and universities are all very attuned to that. And there is this path to not only decarbonize, to get the greenhouse gas emissions out of energy, but also to dewater them, so they need much less water. And all of that fits together in this California plan. And so there are going to be lots of challenges along the way, but what's heartening to me is really something Peter said as well, and that is that this is a evolving picture, and we're looking at how to reduce it. And right now, the really significant growth in solar, right, we're seeing across the state, distributed in central stations, is really a way to reduce the demand on water, to conserve it for other uses, agriculture and for nature.
Governor Brown in his address said, quote, "We must manage farm and rangelands, forests and wetlands so they can store carbon," end quote. But he really didn't mention agriculture. And since we're talking about water, according to a report from the NRDC and the Pacific Institute, 80% of our state's water goes to agriculture, whereas individual use uses only 4%. And, you know, we've done shows about this. This issue is getting so much more attention. How much water does it take to make a pound of beef versus wheat, beef versus driving your car? I mean, this is getting so much more attention, Peter, but politicians aren't really taking this up. Does Jerry Brown talk much about this and we're just not hearing him? Oh. And do you think he should mention this more often?
Well, the need to conserve water in agriculture is foremost on the minds of many of our state's leaders. I think folks are very well aware, in the third year of a drought, maybe heading into the fourth year, that this is a critical urgency. California's water wars over the decades have been legendary, but we think that it's essential that we are as efficient as possible in the use of water, and increasingly so given climate change.
What are your thoughts on this, Dan? Are you hearing politicians talk about this? A study at Cornell found that producing 1 pound of animal protein requires 100 times more water than producing 1 pound of grain protein.
Right. In fact, my lab runs one of the carbon footprint calculator tools called coolcalifornia.org. It's a website you go in and do your footprint of both carbon and water. It's something that the state asked us to do and funded us to do. To do those kinds of analyses, and actually the Cornell group I work quite closely with, those numbers are pretty common. And what it does mean is that if you want to make your system more sustainable, carbon is one piece, but water is another. And I find California leaders are really well aware of this point, but it has been a huge challenge. There's, you know, book after book, there's movies like Chinatown that highlight California's water issues and water wars. And one of the big issues, and this is easier said than dealt with, is that our pricing system for water is really a complicated and often a tragically comical jungle, where there are places where groups, cities, certain farms will actually get paid to use more, or will be incentivized not to conserve, because if they conserve 1 year, then their allocation will be cut, and then if they might need it. So there are engineering issues, and the governor's been very eloquent and active about the issues around levees and our aqueducts. And then there are pricing issues. Actually, those stories in the water world and the carbon world aren't so different. California is now, we're a year into having a market for emissions, so-called cap and trade market. It's certainly not perfect. It arguably is, however, one of the best markets in the world right now. And carbon is trading at a price, and people plan it in. And we're eventually going to need to get to more systematic approaches. Water is one of the areas where we've got to really nail down the market.
Hold that thought, Dan. We're going to take a quick break. Today we are talking about California's green energy future. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call here on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or a question at yourcallradio.org. That's where you'll find links for today's show. Here at KLW, we are sincerely thankful to our listeners' supporters, folks such as Martin Landauer of Daly City and Jim Wilkin of Oakland. They're helping us to start 2015 real strong. Thank you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be discussing media coverage of the U.S. economy, the growing wage gap and unemployment. We'll also talk about the impacts of austerity policies in Europe and the euro plummeting as global oil prices collapse. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the future of California's green energy plans. California Governor Jerry Brown laid out three goals. Last week, half of the state's electricity would come from renewables, reduce petroleum in cars and trucks by up to 50%, and double the efficiency of existing buildings and make heating fuels cleaner. We're talking about this today with Dan Kamen, professor of energy at UC Berkeley, and Peter Miller, senior scientist in the Energy and Transportation Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And thank you for calling, Isabel. Let's go next to Harvey in Berkeley. Hi, Harvey. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for the show, and especially thank you to Dan and Peter for being there right from the beginning with solar and really being leaders in the field and bringing us what we have today. You're great people. I really appreciate it. And with Governor Brown's high-speed rail coming through the Central Valley, I propose that we cover appropriate sections of California's 700-mile-long Central Valley aqueduct system, especially because California's aqueduct system needs to be rebuilt. And at the same time, they can put a photovoltaic canopy or a photovoltaic awning on the side of it to produce electricity. And especially now in time of drought, it would help to slow evaporation and keep the water cleaner and cooler. So that's my proposal, and because we're going to need a lot of electricity to run the new high-speed rail, and it's right there. It's right there in the valley, and it's not taking any additional land. And I think it's a win-win all around, especially with the drought. And
Thank you. Thanks for calling in, Harvey. What are your thoughts on that, Peter?
Well, it's a really exciting time to be in the solar field these days, and there are lots of opportunities. This is an interesting proposal, but there are other ones out there to use solar to help support the state's electricity grid and build the state's economy, both in rooftops, Central Station, or some of the more innovative proposals like your callers here. So there are other technologies as well, which are nipping at the heels of solar, if you will, wind, geothermal, biomass, as well as enabling technologies like new storage technologies, batteries that can help to balance the grid over time. So it's a really exciting time to be in the energy field and lots of interesting proposals out there.
So California currently ranks third in the nation in wind power production and first in installed solar capacity. And a number of people say that this 50% is a major game changer for both of these markets. Jerry Bloom of the law firm Winston & Strawn, who guides renewable energy developers through the permit process, told the LA Times, quote, "Is it significant? Absolutely. Will it stimulate the market? Absolutely." He says that we're just going to see major changes because of this announcement.
That's right. It's really an interesting time to be in this field. And I've been working on environmental and energy issues for many decades. But if you look back 15 years, despite all the efforts, and we're a leader at that point, renewable energy made up a small fraction of the grid, a couple percent of California's electricity supply.
Is that largely due to financing?
That's largely due to technology that was really just in development.
Okay, yeah.
Costs were relatively high, and we didn't have a lot of experience with it. But since the early 2000s, we've made tremendous progress so that, as we mentioned earlier, by 2020, we'll get a third of our electricity from clean, renewable energy. Following on the governor's announcement, 15 years after that, by 2030, 15 years from now, by 2030, we'll get at least 50% of our electricity from renewable energy. If you incorporate the hydropower in the system, we will have transitioned over that 30-year period from a electricity grid that's dominated by fossil fuel generation to one that's by far dominated by clean, renewable electricity. And that's a huge transition. It's a landmark change over a 30-year period that's unparalleled.
And according to the LA Times, I know I keep going back to the LA Times, but they've done really good reporting on this. They report that for a variety of reasons, including the difficulty of obtaining financing and federal subsidies for the construction of billion-dollar plants, utility-scale solar and wind development has fallen off significantly, even as small-scale solar power is burgeoning. Companies have submitted 375 applications for renewable energy-related projects in California. The BLM agency has approved just 18, but these new goals could change that. And Martin Mugisa, president of the Iberdrola Renewables, which is developing wind and solar in the state, says, quote, many thought the initial 33% goal was too challenging, yet California will readily surpass the number. The governor's plan will spark innovation across the electricity sector and clearly encourage large-scale renewable energy development, end quote. So, Dan, what will that large-scale development look like?
Well, I mean, so there's a couple things tied up in that. The largest solar thermal project in the world is in California. And the largest solar photovoltaic, a thin film project, is both in California. Large scale, these are 400, 500 megawatt projects, and a big coal or nuclear power plant is generally 1,000 to 2,000 megawatts. So these are big, big industrial sized plants. The ones that have been built so far have taken significant federal funding. In fact, the big plants in California both received money from President Obama's 2009 stimulus package to get them started. And so no one expects there to be a stimulus package number two. The economies are picked up to some extent. And so these big developers are worried about and looking for funding to take these things on. And that's why we've seen this shift where there is still interest in large-scale projects, both wind and solar, photovoltaic and solar thermal. But there's really been a kind of the revolution, if anything, if you will, has been on smaller distributed projects. The price of solar cells has fallen dramatically. We now all see on the TV and radio and the advertisement saying, convert your home or your small business to solar, and your bill will go down the next month. And that's due to a clever range of financing. You actually typically don't own those panels in that thing. You're effectively leasing roof space. And so what interplay there's going to be between new funding that might come online for big projects, for example, related to President Obama's commitment around climate in this U.S.-China deal, and what extent it's going to be small scale is up for debate. In many of my efforts, what we find is that these small scale projects are a little bit more expensive per capacity built on the rooftop just because they're smaller and distributed, but that it's much faster and easier to put them on, and that the whole industry is learning and growing as a result. And where we are now is that the forecast is that by 2020, if we keep going as we are now, solar is not going to need any subsidy at all. It's going to be cost competitive directly with the baseload power systems. And that really will be the point of revolution. Right now, we're still in a place where the states like California and New Jersey and that have really significant innovative policies to support new solar are seeing a lot of it going on, and states right next door with just as good resources are seeing it not grow as fast. And so it is what the governor said is critically important because it says we are accelerating the course we're on. But I do think that the pieces we've heard here are really seen best as an overall plan, and if we can get neighboring states to pick them up, then we'll see the revolution. Because then we'll start to see large amounts of green power being generated for lots of clients. We'll see much more interstate commerce. We already buy wind power from out of state. And so that's the process that is really critical. And financing is a big gap, but it's primarily for the big projects. The distributed stuff really does have a very sustainable pathway that it's on now.
It's also interesting that the Obama administration has set aside 22 million acres in California to support renewable energy and pledged to generate 20,000 megawatts of power from federal land by 2020, which is enough to power about 6 million homes.
Yeah, it's a key statement. In fact, we're seeing really interesting things like that. So not only is the federal government doing it on federally managed lands, we have lots of examples across California and elsewhere where ranching, for example, and wind is often a great combination where you're using the land multiple times over, very low impact in some cases, and you're getting kind of dual use. There's stories of farmers, documented stories. I know multiple farmers in California, a number in Oklahoma and Iowa, that are getting more for leasing the wind turbines than they're getting for their crops, and so they're delighted to get both rounds of profits. And so what Obama's plans are doing is trying to accelerate that. And the U.S. Military owns and manages a lot of land, and they're also looking at large-scale wind and solar installations. And so all of these things push out that market for green energy, and they really assist places like California, where so many of the financial deals and transactions in the clean energy space pass through.
That is Dan Kamen. He's professor of energy at UC Berkeley. Peter Miller is senior scientist at the Natural Resources Defense Council. And today we are talking about the future for California's energy plans, what's in store in light of California Governor Jerry Brown's three main goals. Half of the state's electricity would come from renewables, reduce petroleum in cars and trucks by up to 50%, double the efficiency of existing buildings, and make heating fuels cleaner. So what questions do you have about this plan? What are your thoughts on this? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Molly in Monterey. Hi, Molly. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so very much for this. It's a great, great moment. Two questions. One I think is really crucial when we talk about wind. What about the birds? There is a visual range. Apparently, if we paint our wind turbines purple, they can see them. Anyway, that's a huge concern of mine because there's so many other depredations on birds. Also, hemp for biodiesel, because it requires requires virtually no water and no toxic inputs.
All right, so let's talk about birds first. The New York Times had a story on this late in 2013 saying while it's unknown how many birds are killed by wind turbines annually, estimates range from 10,000 to more than 500,000. And in 2013, in the first case of its kind, Duke Energy had to pay $1 million in fines after a subsidiary pleaded guilty in federal court to violating the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. The company was charged with killing dozens of birds, including 14 golden eagles at two Wyoming wind farm projects. Environmental groups are really concerned about this. What do you know about specifically birds, Peter?
Yes. No, it's a very good question. Thanks to your caller for raising that. It's critical that we make the transition to clean, renewable energy in order to address the problem of climate change. But in doing so, we have to recognize that these are very large industrial-scale projects to a large extent, and they're going to have their own environmental impacts. And we have to be alert to that. We have to do what we can to minimize those impacts, in particular to birds, but also to terrestrial species like tortoises and other species in the desert.
Right.
It's critical that we do this in a way that doesn't cause other unnecessary problems. I think it's important to look at the problems with birds in context. Far more birds are killed by, for example, pet cats than renewable energy. But that's not to put forward an excuse for not addressing these problems to the greatest extent possible. And there's been an enormous amount of work put into siting of these projects in a way that minimizes environmental impacts.
What are your thoughts on this, Dan? How do you strike the right balance here?
Right. So, I mean, the statements like cats kill birds is true. Actually, many more birds, it turns out, are killed by automobiles on the roads by an order of magnitude. And actually, fossil fuel power plants actually cause more deaths of birds. It was recently determined in terms of impact on landscape and in terms of pollution. So putting the numbers in context is critical, but also doing the projects you do right is critical. And so that suit with Duke Energy is a good example of there was an opportunity to site a wind farm in a couple locations. The one that was chosen actually impacted a migratory route. And so I think that fine and that process was the correct, correct response. What's interesting, though, is that the evolution of wind turbines themselves has also changed the story. The early wind turbines, if you go through the Altamont Pass in Northern California, is a lot of very small machines with small blades moving very rapidly. And as we've transitioned to bigger and bigger machines, actually, the bird impact has gone way down.
Hmm.
The bigger machines, the tip is moving very fast, but it's a big piece of blade. This is a structure taller than the Eiffel Tower. And in that structure, actually, the bird impact per turbine just goes down. And so technology has given us a start. The color are rightly identified, not only things like coloring turbines, but also one can have sound warning systems. So all these things are evolving. And minimizing the footprint of our energy system isn't just about carbon. It's also about landscape and birds and the tortoises. And when done right, we're finding that this sort of clean energy story can really improve that. But it can also be done wrong. And there are ongoing, very tense battles over wind farms in certain places. And I think that just a broad statement Peter said, that all these big technologies have impacts, and we need to be cognizant and manage them. And that's really the path that California's been looking at. And so the bird damage numbers, the bird death numbers, has been something which has been studied for years. We do see it going down, but that still means you have to be vigilant and keep looking for the places where you can reduce the impact of your technologies wherever possible.
And do either of you have any comments on hemp as a biofuel?
I don't have any comments on specifically on hemp as a biofuel, but it's a really interesting area in general. Mm-hmm. The effort to develop alternatives to petroleum fuel, that was clearly one of Governor Brown's announcements. We need to reduce the carbon content of our liquid fuels, and there's a lot of exciting work going on there. I think for those who are in this burgeoning industry, there's interesting work going on looking at algae as fuels, a whole different variety of purpose-grown crops.
Senator Wyden just introduced a bill last week to legalize industrial hemp cultivation and production in a congressional committee. So this is getting attention on Capitol Hill also.
Right? Yeah, and hemp's a really attractive crop because it can be grown on some degraded lands. It doesn't require a lot of water. It's one of the bioenergy crops that's been studied as a sustainable form of biofuel. And California has been a national and global leader in establishing rules so that we recognize that not every biofuel is created equal.
Right.
The environmental impact of using urban food waste is, of course, much less than, for example, dedicating acreage to corn, for example. And so my lab and others have been really engaged in understanding what is that life cycle, that cradle-to-grave impact of different fuels. And thankfully, California's standard, and now the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's standard, recognizes that and says if you do sustainable biofuels, you get a higher credit as a green fuel. And there are some biofuels that are worse than the petroleum things they replace because their life cycle impact on land, on water, on fertilizers is higher than the alternative. So it's not just that all renewables are good and all fossil fuels are bad. It's that we need to do the math and we need to look at what they are. And thankfully, California's low carbon fuel standard, something that's been fought over a lot, lots of competing analysis, is really one of the most important forums for having that debate. And so hemp scores very well in this process. Offtakes from forest, recycling urban waste all score very high, and land and water and fertilizer-intensive biofuels score very poorly, and so they don't actually benefit us much environmentally, and the rules are designed to reflect that.
Well, thank you for calling, Molly. The Senate bill is called the Industrial Hemp Farming Act of 2015. It would remove federal restrictions on the domestic cultivation of industrial hemp, and I'll add that to my show ideas, so thanks for calling in. I wanted to talk about, we're almost out of time, we've got two more things to talk about. We've got an email from Mark on cars. Clearly electric cars, he writes, using an evergreener grid is a double win in that it replaces the dirtiest and most politically noxious fuel, petroleum. The message from environmental organizations has long been confusing to me. Better gas cars and a bit of ethanol, biofuels, hydrogen, and electric vehicles. Do your guests now believe that battery electric cars are the best way forward? Peter, do you want to take that first?
Well, we do believe that battery electric cars are a critical part of the solution. They're going to be increasingly common on the streets of California. And it's a really exciting opportunity, as your caller or writer points out, because they provide a way to help balance the grid, to take that excess solar energy that is produced in the middle of the day and store it for use at night. So it's a really exciting win-win opportunity. I think it's also essential that we point out that it provides some energy security for the state and helps to protect the economy when gasoline prices jump up unexpectedly. We've seen a decrease in prices over the past 6 months, but I think anyone who's alert to history can expect it.
And when Governor Brown says the plan is to reduce petroleum use in cars and trucks by up to 50%, fuel efficiency came to mind. Is that what he's talking about?
Fuel efficiency is a critical part of it, obviously. More efficient cars help to reduce petroleum use, but also looking at alternative fuels, not just electricity, but hydrogen and fuel cell vehicles.
And so the infrastructure will have to be ramped up for this, because for electric cars, you need a plug-in station. Right?
Yes.
And so, well, right now, electric cars are still fairly expensive,
well,
I understand.
Not really,
are they not?
Well, so it turns out that in the last couple of years, electric vehicles have come down so that you can basically find electric vehicles from kind of the smallest smart cars to mid-sized sedans to the ones that get a lot of attention, the kind of luxury ones like the neat Teslas and the Pritzkers. There's now electric vehicles really across the whole spectrum, and there are federal rebates for purchasing them. And so you can buy a Nissan Leaf for just about the cost of an equivalent vehicle, and it has, you know, you're charging it up by, you're not buying petroleum. And so that is a dramatic economic benefit for the individual right off. If you say, I mean, gas is going way down right now, but let's say gas is $2.50 a gallon. You get the same distance traveled in your electric vehicle, and the equivalent cost isn't $2.50 a gallon equivalent, say, for 25 miles. It's actually around 65 to 70 cents. So there's an economic plus side here in the story as well. And so the standard to reduce petroleum use by 50% does come with mixing in sustainable biofuels, potentially some hydrogen, but also really shifting the state dramatically towards electric vehicles. And I think the listener really hit on the point. When you hear the old debate about more efficient vehicles, it was largely people battling for the so-called CAFE standards, the fleet economy standards, and saying, should it be a little higher or a little lower? We have a reasonable standard now that President Obama has signed for 2020. But it's really that shift over. And so California 10 years ago was betting on really just more efficient vehicles. But now with the advent, first of hybrids, now of electric vehicles, now we see a way to really jump the conversation. And so an electric vehicle powered with California's very clean grid today gets over 100 mile per gallon equivalent. And every step we take to add more renewables on the grid, that means a vehicle charging up with that is going to give you a higher mileage. And so we're now talking about standards down the road where we're thinking about the equivalent mile per gallon for an electric vehicle driven in a super clean grid area like parts of California. Now we're talking about like 200 miles per gallon. And just a few years ago, we were arguing about should the fuel standard be 20 or 24 miles a gallon. So it's an order of magnitude improvement that technology has pushed, but markets and policies like California has really enabled and grown.
All right. Well, thank you for the email. On buildings, I know we could do a whole show on each, on all three of these. Lennon writes in and says the goal of a 50% increase in the energy efficiency of buildings should deal with heating unit efficiency and solar domestic hot water installations and photovoltaic roof panels, rainwater collection and reuse. This should be discussed thoroughly. So, Peter, what are your thoughts on Governor Brown's plan, double the efficiency of existing buildings and make heating fuels cleaner? What changes are we going to see?
California has been a leader in improving the efficiency of buildings for many decades. What Governor Brown's statement points out is that we need to redouble our efforts effectively. We need to get twice as much savings as we've been getting from those programs we have in the past. So it's a challenge to those who are helping to run those programs, who are creating the opportunities for Californians, both on the technology side and the program side. It points out that there's a huge opportunity to invest further in what is really our cheapest, cleanest, easiest, and fastest resource, and that's improving the efficiency with which we use electricity and fuels.
And Peter, what would you add to that? We did a show years ago about buildings. It doesn't get much attention, but according to reports, buildings account for about 39% of CO2 emissions in the U.S., consuming more energy than almost any other sector.
Right. I mean, buildings are critical, and they effectively live, they get used for a long time, and so you make a poor choice or you don't upgrade a building to make it smarter, and you live with that decision for a long time. And California has always pushed these standards. We have some of the most aggressive standards for business buildings and homes. And in fact, the California Public Utilities Commission is calling for every home that built in California after 2020 to generate more energy than it needs and to generate clean energy, so solar on the rooftop or a heat pump or something else. And for our office buildings to get there, net zero energy, as it's called, by 2030. And those are the 2020 standard for homes we know how to do now. The 2031 is a real stretch, and that's another great piece of what's embedded in the governor's statements. That is, we need to keep pushing that envelope, and buildings are a resource that now, with smart technology, with sensors, with a smarter grid, you're talking about buildings that are the hub of charging up electric vehicles, a place where we can really beat down the energy use with better lighting and heating systems. So everything the caller said in that list is part of what California is working on. And there's people across the state agencies and at the universities, think tanks, groups, all really engaged in that doing so. And getting the governor to say it is really critical, because it puts everyone kind of on high alert that we need all of these things, and there will be state programs that will call for all of these things to be implemented.
Final thoughts, Peter. What does this mean for the future of the economy in California?
Well, this the governor's statement really encapsulates the vision for the clean energy economy going forward. It's a great opportunity for California to build jobs, to create jobs, to build the economy on a stable basis that provides leadership for California companies in products and in technologies that we can sell to the world. California companies and the government really is leading here.
Peter Miller is senior scientist in the Energy and Transportation Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council, and Dan Kamen is professor of energy at UC Berkeley. Peter and Dan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. You can find links to read about Governor Jerry Brown's plan at yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the U.S. economy, the growing wage gap, and unemployment. We'll also talk about the impacts of austerity policies in Europe and the euro plummeting as global oil prices collapse. We'll be joined by The Washington Post's Jim Tankersley, The Huffington Post's Arthur Delaney, and The Globe and Mail's Eric Reguli. What caught your attention in the media this week? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Nock Nguyen produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.